and a good sense of humor. Laughter is good medicine. I come from an ancestral matrilineal society where women are leaders, role models, and teachers of peace, love, harmony, humility, humanity, truth, conversation, and a coming together in our sacred circle of unity. Others may choose to follow in our ways. I am here accepting this apology, not only for me alone, but as the acknowledgement, knowing that it was not only for me, but for all of our nations that also need to hear and deserve this apology tonight.
Sasheen Littlefeather, speaking in September. She died at the age of 75 on October 2nd. That does it for our show. We have two full-time job openings, Associate Digital Editor and People and Culture Manager, and we welcome back Tammy Warrenoff. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Finance Committee meets the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify that a meeting is being held.
Are you a fan of the independent film news and interviews on The Film Show? Well, you won't want to miss the new and expanded Words and Pictures, coming in 2019. That's right! The Film Show and Words and Pictures are coming together to fill the airwaves with the most creative happenings and fertile minds in screencraft, stagecraft, comics, and animation. So tune in to KBOO twice a month, 11:30 a.m. every second and fourth Thursday in 2019 and beyond for the very best of the narrative arts on the new Words and Pictures.
Back home,
folks. Our goal is to create an atmosphere devoid of genre, a place where quality is key. It's important for the world and future generations to understand the power of art and music. Ultimately, we are doing our part to carry on tradition. Tune into Passing Sound, the first Saturday of each month at 10 p.m. on KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM, or kboo.fm, where we make musical structures for the listener to enjoy.
Today is a special day because we have an easy reminder of the long and valuable history of these lands, and indeed of our entire continent. Long before the slow and progressive colonization process, with all its myriad of terrible things that have become part of the history of our nation, our lands were inhabited by humble yet brilliant people who lived in perfect consonance with the world around them. Their legacy is evident in the well-known Native American philosophies and understandings of life and the world. It has never been easy anywhere in the world for people to assimilate to an overwhelming, seemingly undefeatable military force. And this has caused enormous pain and distress everywhere on the earth. The ages past were barbaric, cruel, and almost difficult to accept as things that actually happened. People who were humble, living with the land, in sisterhood and brotherhood with each other, and who never had the need or resources to develop advanced warring technologies, found themselves overburdened to the point of extinction. Here in America, during the 1800s and even well into the 20th century, specific policies were developed and carried out by a great number of governmental agencies. Many of these policies were clearly and openly designed to disempower indigenous people of everything that gave them sovereignty and self-sufficiency. The local indigenous languages and cultural expressions were made illegal, and this continued for many years. Unchallenged by the federal government or the executive and judicial branches of government, boarding schools were created, and many indigenous children were forcibly removed from their families in order to ensure that they would be assimilated into the standard English-American culture and customs. The amount of trauma many thousands of Native Americans have experienced is almost beyond the capacity to put into words. When the language and culture of people is denigrated and ignored to the point of making it illegal, that's when we can safely see things were taken too far. We have lived dark times in this world, but the spirit inside all of us has proven to be indestructible. Our bodies and minds can be easily damaged, but our spirit cannot be destroyed. This belief in the sacredness of life beyond what we can see has kept many indigenous people grounded on what they believe is right, and not only that, but on the best that their ancestral culture, knowledge, and philosophy can offer the world. Today, we live in a very different time. The work of countless activists, intellectuals, and even entrepreneurs has propelled our nation to a very different place. A place where we can see the errors made in ages past, and we can deflect them from occurring again with apparent ease. As a nation and a world, we are growing up. Western culture and interests are evolving to a point that many of us see as beneficial to all of us if we are able to use our massive resources to do what is right, and not only what corporate interests believe is right for them. We certainly have enormous challenges ahead, but many of us are certain that it is indeed possible to take action and fix many wrongs that are currently de facto running our entire world. We have a serious emergency situation with the way we interact with our environment. We see it every day in what we have named climate change, and this is a very real event that is taking place before our very eyes. In addition to that, we seem to have a tragic relationship with our fellow beings in the world, and more species are becoming closer to extinction. Butterflies, dragonflies, and bees are slowly but surely disappearing. Spectacular animals like the tiger are already considered endangered. The northern white rhino became extinct in 2018. The vaquita, the smallest cetacean in the world, is on the brink of extinction with an estimated of 20 individuals in the wild. And this is not to mention the devastating factory farm paradigm that we live in, where millions of cows, pigs, and chickens are treated like lifeless commodities in sterile and unnatural industrial facilities. This is far from the natural ways humans harvested animal flesh before industrialization, and it doesn't show the best that the human spirit can achieve. At times, after seeing so much disorder in the world, many wonder, are we actually going to make it, or are we done for? Well, many of us are certain that yes, we are going to make it. Our world is going to make it. Our fellow beings are going to make it. We will not destroy the oceans. We will not destroy the world. We will find a way to organize to a point where we can make real decisions that can be of real benefit to people and nature. And all these superb changes that many of us foresee must be informed and inspired by indigenous wisdom, that ancient, deeply philosophical way of understanding how humans are supposed to behave with each other and our environment. We want to give a special shout out to Deb Haaland, the first Native American to serve as a cabinet secretary, as the Secretary of the Department of the Interior. This is a sign that we are on the right path, because what better person to manage the Department of the Interior than a Native American woman? Last November, Deb Haaland issued Secretary's Order 3404, which declared the word squaw to be a derogatory term and created a task force to identify its use in names of geographic features on federal lands and find replacements. This word has a long history of disempowering indigenous women. Stolen from the word for woman in one specific indigenous language, possibly Algonquian, the word has been distorted and turned into a powerful racial slur, able to remove individual identity and dignity from many women of Native American heritage. This has effectively denied the humanity of generations of Native wives, daughters, and mothers. In broad, traditional Native American culture, woman and mother are sacred beyond the limitations of our current age, and this must be remembered because it is crucial we accept woman and mother as the givers and sustainers of life, and must be honored with all our might. Now, let's celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day today with the thought that we can achieve amazing things in America if we dare to supplement our policies, actions, and goals with Indigenous knowledge, philosophy, and wisdom.
Hi, this is Pat Metheny. You're listening to Radio KBOO here in Portland.
Hello, and you're listening to EcoJustice Radio, a project of SoCal 350 Climate Action. Our show presents environmental and climate stories from a social justice frame, featuring voices not necessarily heard on traditional, mainstream, or even public media outlets. Welcome. I am Jessica Aldridge. On today's show, Cultural Fire, Native Land Management, and Regeneration, host Carrie Kim interviews Elizabeth Azus, Secretary of Cultural Fire Management Council. They discuss her work using traditional Native Karuk methods of prescribed burning to protect forests, hill-degraded ecosystems, and reestablish forest-grown food, medicine, and products. Elizabeth Azus is a cultural fire practitioner. She gathers and propagates traditional food and medicinal plants. Of Yurok and Karuk descent, she comes from and lives in her traditional territory where the Trinity River flows into the Klamath on the north coast of California. Elizabeth is a mother and grandmother. At the age of four, she learned about burning from her grandfather. Native peoples used the tool of fire as medicine. Fire was understood to be a spirit, a healer, and sacred in its own right. Traditional native controlled burning, called cultural fire, utilizes ancient agroforestry practices, technology developed throughout time by the Karuk tribe and indigenous peoples around the world. The goal is to manage the forest landscape to provide for wildlife and people to safely coexist and thrive in an increasingly volatile ecosystem. With global climate heating turning the west coast of the U.S. into an arid tinderbox, it's been another year of the megafire. Thus, the work of Elizabeth Azus and the Cultural Fire Management Council sets an important example of how to protect and regenerate forests for the people and wildlife who call them home using traditional ecological knowledge. Thank you for tuning into Cultural Fire, Native Land Management and Regeneration.
Aloha. Thank you for tuning in. This is Carrie Kim. We come to you from Tongva lands, aka Los Angeles, and give thanks to the Tongva ancestors who have stewarded these lands for countless millennia. I wanted to open with Reviewing this past year has been the year of the megafire. Some will say we live in the age of the megafire. More than 5 million acres, I'm sure plus, have burned in California, Colorado, Oregon, Washington. And also we have seen massive fires from Siberia to Australia and also in the Arctic. And this age of megafire is compelling us to rediscover fire as a healer, as a spirit, as medicine for the earth. And to help us understand how to cultivate right relationship with fire, we welcome on the show today Elizabeth Azuz, Secretary of Cultural Fire Management Council. She is a cultural fire practitioner and a gatherer of traditional foods and medicines who comes from the villages of Wichbus and Katamin. And she is a mother and a grandmother and has learned about burning by her Karuk grandfather since she was 4. Welcome, Elizabeth. We are grateful to have you bring your wisdom and traditional knowledge to this show today. So to begin, I wanted to ask you just the fundamental question, if you could please define cultural burning. What is it?
Cultural burning for us is a way to restore our land. It's our connection to the land, to the trees, plants, animals, all beings. We coexist here. Cultural burning for me is a way to restore our traditional foods, medicines, restore our hunting grounds, our gathering grounds. In times past, 7 generations past, you know, the women cared for our gathering areas while the men cared for their hunting areas. And then we came to 100 years of fire suppression, where we weren't allowed to take care of the land any longer, which brings us to our current state of being, where fire has taken over great swaths of land and caused large amounts of distress for people who fear fire. They don't know fire. Mm-hmm. So cultural burning for us means that we don't have those things happen in our environment. We burn around our elders' homes to protect them. We build around, burn around young families' homes in our family burning projects. So we're actively trying to clean up 100 years worth of debris, dead and down fuels in forest areas. And it's going to require all of us, not just our people, but all people on this earth to help cleanse our mother.
Agreed, 100% agreed. And I would also add, you know, 100 years and maybe 500 years of deep ignorance, or, you know, having forgotten a lot, for having forgotten our ancestors, ancestral ways, forgotten where we come from, and so much more. But that's the back history that so many of us share. I wanted to also ask you, as you are part of the Cultural Fire Management Council, what the aim of this org is and what the gestation of was it? How did it come into being?
Yes, our executive director, Margot Robbins, is also a weaver. She's an extraordinary weaver, by the way, grandmother, mother. She started burning initially for basket materials. Mm-hmm. Our women were running out of hazel sticks, mm-hmm. and they require fire. They're a serotonous plant. If they're not burned, they're not pliable. They're not weavable. Mm-hmm. And so we had many of our elder women coming to her and saying, you know, we don't have any sticks. We can't make baskets anymore. We can't teach our young women, you know, what are we going to do? And so she started her first burn in 2013. It was 7 acres done by the Yurok tribe and Cal Fire, mm-hmm. with our small local organizing group.
Okay.
So just being able to, you know, get fire back on the ground, we started with a group called Building Healthy Communities. They came in, they talked to us about what our community wanted, what did we need. And if you know anything about a reservation, you know, we have a store, a small church, a 2-room school, and a small community center. Mm-hmm. That's all that's here. Mm-hmm. The people didn't ask for buses or groceries or even a laundromat. We don't have any of these things. Mm-hmm. They wanted to put fire back on the ground. That was their primary goal, was to bring fire back to the landscape. Mm-hmm. And so our board are our elders. We, you know, talk to them, see what's the best advice, and we work very hard. And Margot created a nonprofit Cultural Fire Management Council. And here we are 7 years later, fully funded, working well on the land, and we now have a full-time crew and all of our own equipment.
That is amazing. So how many people deep is your organization at this point over 7 years? I'm sure it's grown.
You know, it hasn't grown as much as it could probably. This year is the first time we'll hire a full-time crew of five. Mm-hmm. Our board has approximately seven members, and we have two seats that are held by your tribal council reps mm-hmm. for our districts that we live in. Mm-hmm. So we partner with our tribe. We work with them. We partner with CAL FIRE and the Forest Service and various other tribes in the area to make these burns happen. And we also work with the Nature Conservancy and the Fire Learning Network.
What is the Fire Learning Network with the Nature Conservancy? Are they doing it nationwide or?
It is. They produced a newsletter. From the Fire Learning Network came our group, the Indigenous Peoples Burning Network, mm-hmm. where we're reaching out to tribes all across the United States to get their burning rights back.
That is amazing. Yeah, that is so powerful. And that has been, they've been working for that over these 7 years too, or is it longer than that has existed?
No, the IPBN is a little younger than Cultural Fire. Uh-huh. The Nature Conservancy and the Fire Learning Network are a group. And so we work with Mary Huffman at the Nature Conservancy for the IPBN.
Okay.
She's been a wonderful leader, helped us to build this, and we co-manage it with the Karuk and Hupa tribe.
Mm-hmm. So how did that come about, the co-management with the Karuk and Hupa? Was it something that you reached out to them, or simultaneously really the tribes knew they had to come together to unite and help this come into being?
Margo and Mary Huffman actually had quite a few meetings about it. And then they brought in Renee Stoffer from Karuk, Bill Tripp from Karuk, Dr. Lake. We brought in Nolan Colgrove from the Forest Service and Merv George from the Forest Service. And we worked with the Hoopa Fire Department and some of their people there, their basket weavers. They also had a great interest in getting their materials back. Mm-hmm. And so what happened was, as you know, many tribes cannot get along. We cannot seem to work together, but we did have a common ground in wanting to bring fire back and to restore our materials and our land. Mm-hmm. And so this group allows us to all sit in a room together and build a healthy country plan. Mm-hmm. So we created a healthy country plan, and it basically is the goal of restoring this land back to creation.
This is so inspiring to learn about. You know, I didn't know. I don't know if, you know, anyone else, any of our other listeners knew of this network, you know, the burning network. And it's so wonderful to know that this is happening. And, you know, I wondered, what have you seen, having been in this for now 7 years, seen this evolution, what have you seen change in the environments where you're conducting cultural burns, in the biodiversity?
Most amazing change for me? Mm-hmm. Yeah, the greatest change for me is we're doing prairie and meadow restoration to restore the elk habitat in our territory. Mm-hmm. So our elk will travel from the coast up into the high country. Uh-huh. And I've actually seen some in the area where I live, which is almost in the middle of the territory they will need to travel through. So we work with many universities. Oh, yes. Since my father. And he's been gone 20 years now.
Wow. That you hadn't seen elk.
I hadn't seen any in our territory. Oh, no, we've seen them everywhere, but not here in our territory.
Right.
They haven't been able to cross the mountains because of all of the debris. There's none of the foods they like to eat. They're very particular about their diet. Mm-hmm. And so a part of that is we have botanists and students from many backgrounds come out and study the hazel, the acorns, the huckleberries, the elk. You know, mm-hmm. it's amazing to watch a grad student follow an elk around collecting scat and think that's the most amazing thing on earth.
Are they from Humboldt State, or which where are they from, these students?
Well, there's Dr. Sifa Ramos is from Humboldt State. She's studying elk. We have Dr. Tony Marks Blocks from Stanford. He studied our hazel and worked with Dr. Lake. So, you know, we have so many amazing people. Ariel Halperin, she studied acorns. So all of these studies go back to the tribes. The traditional ecological knowledge stays with the people. They produce their papers and we retain the rights to them.
That's the way it should be. Yes. You know, I'm wondering, given where you are and what you have learned yourself since the age of four with your grandfather, you know, what you would most want to impart to listeners about fire?
When I was four, my grandfather, who was blind, he was Karuk, caught me burning. He could smell, obviously, very well. And so he decided to sit me down and explain that fire is not a toy. Fire is a tool, and fire is family. Fire is something we use to heat our food, to keep us warm, to restore our land, to care for the animals, the one-legged tree people. You know, there are so many variations on how we all fit in this world. But for me, you know, the greatest thing has been watching the youth come into this and fully understand their place in our environment and want to restore it. So that has been the greatest thing for me is, you know, now I'm a grandmother, so I'm going to be teaching my grandchildren about fire now. My grandson, who's 19 months, only wants to burn angelica root in the morning and at night. That's his first thought, is to burn his root.
I love that.
You know,
that.
And it's the funniest thing.
I love that. I
me
love
too. He stands in front of it and he, yeah. Yeah, so he needs to burn his medicine in the morning and at night, and then he's comfortable.
Well, it's a very strange thing. We had someone else on the show, Taylor Bright, speaking about bioremediation and microremediation with fire, and we got into the topic of fear around fire. And then I also was pondering, you know, pyromania, I was wondering, just musing about it, that perhaps pyromania is also some kind of distortion about some original relationship with fire that hasn't been intact. And so it comes out as this strange perversion.
Yeah.
It's just gone the wrong way because it's lacking in the person's,
yeah.
They don't have relationship with it anymore. So it becomes something more destructive.
That's true. You know, for me, growing up as a young woman, when we were in ceremony, you're not allowed to look in the fire. You look below it or you look above it, but you don't look into it. And now as an adult, I no longer participate in ceremony except for, you know, in the kitchen or helping. Mm-hmm. But there's a piece of me that just, I am drawn to fire. You know, I love the work it does. I love the smell. I can tell by the smells of smoke what's burning, you know. It's just, for me, fire is family. It's a necessary tool to keep our home and our environment safe. Mm-hmm. But it also provides so many things, you know, our huckleberries, the smoke from the fire kills the weevils that destroy our acorns, kills the moths that, you know, destroy certain foods. Smoke also creates an inversion layer over the river to cool the water down for the fish so that they can swim upstream, you know, in cooler waters. There's so many things that fire and smoke do that humans don't even think about. You know, it's just an inconvenience to them.
Right.
To me, it's, you know, it's frightening to see the look on people's face, but inside I smile very large because I want to see the earth cleaned.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is the era of people coming to remember our interdependence. And as you said, all peoples have to come together to heal and restore Mother Earth, you know, to her, just her original state, the way, I don't mean original, like she doesn't evolve, but just back to where we are taking care of her.
Yeah.
You know, I, Ron Good, I watched a documentary from KCET, Tending the Wild, and it was about cultural burning. And Ron Good, who's of the Mono tribe, I don't know if he's still chairman, but he had said, if you are afraid of fire, you won't understand fire. And so, you know, I think of the many people who are divorced from the natural world, and also they lead more of a materially driven versus spiritually led life. And so, you know, I have to say, I've honestly never met a native person who was afraid of fire.
It's true.
No, I don't know how you work within those frameworks, because I know you also work with firefighters, right? You also help train firefighters in a particular way, or I'm not exactly sure what the extent of that is, your training with firefighters.
We do. We utilize firefighters. We train firelighters.
Firelighters.
We work with firefighters who are used to suppression. And we have recently trained some that have never used a drip torch at all. They have absolutely no idea what they're going to get into. And so when they come, at first they're a little upset that they only have, you know, what do you mean? This is all we're doing. We're training to do what? But, you know, we're almost having to untrain some habits and retrain them to know that it's okay to do what we're doing.
No, meaning that it's kind of the opposite of what they're trained to do. To be the fire lighter.
Absolutely. It's extremely opposite.
Right. But it's probably very liberating for them once they go through that process. I mean, do you feel that they have a big...
We've had some people not want to leave us.
I'm sure they probably wanted to...
Quite a few people that don't want to leave. Yeah, they want to stay and work.
They want to be on your crew, your full-time crew. Yeah, I get it. I mean, of course, it makes perfect sense. Yeah. And, you know, what they're doing, they have to be around a lot more toxicity.
Absolutely.
Hey, listeners, quick break here. We hope that you're enjoying Eco Justice Radio. Stay connected by subscribing on all major podcast apps and visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org, to check out previous shows and guests and get connected with us on social media. Today, you are listening to Cultural Fire, Native Land Management and Regeneration with guest Elizabeth Azus of Cultural Fire Management Council and host Carrie Kim.
Could you explain when people say, well, Native peoples, like, for example, Ron Good, again, I heard this from him, that he has said the land needs fire. So a lot of people do not understand this, or they're something they've never heard before. And I'm wondering if you could explain to them, why does the land need fire? And
the land needs fire because the majority of their plants are serotonous. If they don't have fire, certain cones from certain trees don't open. Certain plants are not usable, not edible, don't produce well. You know, there was a natural balance to things before humans came along and pushed our way into that environment and tried to control it. You know, humans need to realize one thing. We're not in control. Mm-hmm. We are in the middle of all of this with everything else, and we need to learn to work together. You know, this is the hardest thing for humans to do. We all think everything is our way or no way at all, which is furthest from the truth. You know, when you're out in the environment, when you're out burning, you're looking at the wind, you're looking at the humidity, you know, there's so many things that come into play before you can actually lay fire on the ground and watch it do its work. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we were talking about what we do with suppression and prescribed fire. The Nature Conservancy works with us in training participants from all over the world. They come from Spain. I have a dear friend in Switzerland who came to watch to try to understand why I love fire so much. You know, the whole piece of training, whole piece of training to burn is something that suppression firefighters are not taught. You know, they know how to clean up around a fire. They know how to make it look all nice, but they don't know how to make it look nice from start to finish. Mm-hmm. You know, they come into an area that's burnt and it's, you know, just trashed, and they have to try to put that out and clean it up. Right. We go into an area that has a lot of down brush and debris. We burn it off, and the ash and the charcoal filter through into the water table, restores the creeks and the rivers and the aquatic life. You know, that ash also helps remove ticks and fleas from the animals that roll in that ash. There's so many things that are almost symbiotic in nature and humanity, but humans tend to push that away because they don't understand it. The more they move back towards it, the more they learn that their food comes from the land. You know, the animals, the water, the creatures that live here with us, we'll start to take better care of them.
Yeah, I think shifting from this Anthropocene kind of focus that everything is about human beings. I mean, one of the things that always disturbs me when you see any fires be covered on the media as if immediately what they speak about is structures. How many structures burned? And nobody speaks about, well, how many animals died? How much habitat was lost? How many, you know, microbes died? And who keeps track of that? They don't.
Absolutely.
And it's a great, great loss for the entire planet.
It
everywhere.
Is.
So, you know,
yeah,
it's not the most important thing. And, you know, of course, we know that there's been so much encroachment into wildlands and people building where there shouldn't be buildings.
Yeah.
There's so much that needs to change.
Well, like I said, humans don't realize that they're not here alone.
Yeah. Well, I think this is also the thing, what you were talking about with fire, that fire and also all of the elements teach us humility and teach us literally that we're not in charge and we're not in control of everything that happens.
Absolutely. One of our favorite things is that our group has never lost a controlled burn. We kind of pride ourselves on the fact that we've never lost a prescribed fire. Mm-hmm. There are quite a few agencies and groups, you know, that start out well-intended, but they go too big. They go too big too fast, and they lose control. That's something you don't want to do with fire, is get cocky.
Yeah.
Because you're not in charge. You think you are, but you're not.
Right. So do you think most of those things, I mean, if ever it does go out of control, it's mostly out of some kind of an arrogance or overconfidence?
In general, sometimes, you know, people just tend to want to go big or go home kind of thing. You know? I tend to like to, you know, pick things off in pieces, you know.
Yeah. Now, I have a question for you about scale, because we know that we've kind of pushed the envelope so far with the sort of way we have lived in a destructive way with nature, that I wonder what you feel, you know, even if this spreads, you know, worldwide, you know, where we are and what the possibility is for restoration this way, you know, because we know we're way, way, way past the 11th hour here with climate change and all of the nature of things here now. So, you know, I wonder what comes to your mind, what do you think about as far as scaling this up or being able to really change sort of the course, change the trajectory here of what everyone has these dire predictions of the increase of fires projected?
Well, I'm lucky in this area to be able to work with a lot of amazing fire women. Lainey Quinn Davidson, we work with, she's in the Humboldt County area. She is teaching certified prescribed burn bosses. So these are burn bosses that don't have to go through the NWCG qualification process. Uh-huh. It doesn't take you 10 to 12 years to become a burn boss. Uh-huh. It's a course that you go through, you do the training, you participate in the class, you do all the tests, and you get your burn boss to do prescribed burning. That doesn't mean we can go out and control a major fire that's happening anywhere in this continent. It just means that we're capable of leading a prescribed burn. Margo and I will be taking one of those trainings from her. And I really look forward to that, because I am one of the people who refuses to become NWCG qualified, because I don't believe that the government has the right to tell us as Native people how to restore our land. And I don't believe I need a red card to do that. You know, that piece of paper isn't going to give me any more of the nerve I have now. It's not going to help me. What I want to do is to be able to help people learn that, you know, the land and the people need to work together. We're not there to take it over. We're not there to pour fuel all over it and burn it to death. We're there to work in certain areas. Some areas have low intensity burns. Some need high intensity burns. Certain plants require certain heat. This is why I'm amazed at their knowledge. We give them knowledge, and we've had some very long-term relationships with them.
When you said NWCG, I don't know what that stands for, the acronym.
You know, I can't even remember the acronym, but basically it's the qualifications required by all government fire agencies.
Okay.
So, please excuse me, I can't remember the acronym.
That's okay. Yeah.
I just know that it's...
You know, what their purpose is. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I wondered how it is, your relationship with fire, and how that has evolved and how that has been. You know, whether they are you know, humble enough to listen, how that works.
We have a great relationship with CAL FIRE, actually. They gave us an award for cooperation with them. We partnered in, we're on our second grant with them now. This is, our first grant was very nice. This one is extremely large, and it gives us the funding we need to continue to build our projects and our, you know, purchase the equipment we need and train the people we need to keep moving with this project.
I wonder, you know, how expensive it is even to do some of these burns, like what really is entailed to do them, you know?
You know, when we put on a training exchange, it's usually 10 days. We have a facility, we provide catering, we provide all of the fuels, equipment. People that come in for our trainings, if they bring their own equipment, their own trucks, they don't have to pay the fees. The majority of them can train to increase their qualifications and whatever, you know, if they want to be a burn boss or a firing boss or a holding boss, you know, there are many different things they can train in. And so we have our repeat offenders, I call them, because they continually come back, not because of the training, but because of feel, you know, respected and heard. They like the way that we work. And so they want to come back and they want to teach younger generations how to do this right.
So is there any age limit to the trainings or anyone?
We do field trips. We bring out the students from Head Start all the way to high school. But in order to participate with us, you have to be 18 years old because you will be using equipment, chainsaws, weed whackers, you know, dangerous pieces of equipment. But they're taught how to use them. There are trainers there that teach them how to be safe with chainsaws and how to take care of their equipment, how to run an engine. So they learn everything they need to be safe in our environment.
Can you clarify the difference between when you say cultural burn or prescribed burn? Is the prescribed burn just the one that you have kind of scheduled to happen? Or I'm not sure what the difference is.
Prescribed burn, we do training exchanges twice a year, once in the spring and once in the fall. And those are broadcast burns. They have to be in prescription, basically, you know, certain time of the day, certain winds, certain moistures, humidities, you know, it, all of that plays into, it's a prescription, basically. It's written out in a document. We follow it, you know, the best we can. Our family-based burning does not require a burn plan. I do work very close with the air quality people because I want them to be on our side. And even though we're a sovereign nation, we have our own air quality department. I work with both the county and our tribal.
So do you have to get some kind of approval to work? And what is, how do you involve them on the air quality?
Well, Humboldt County Air Quality, per se, they control the permits for fee land. So people who have fee land have to get permits from the air quality. They have to have certain things in place before they can burn on their land.
I see.
When we burn on people's fee land, I approach air quality. I get all the I need for the entire area that we're going to be working on. And I have a really good relationship with them. So I feel very comfortable in, you know, working with them and our tribal air quality in order to make everything and everyone very happy.
I wonder if you could share again that story you were talking to me about before we began about, you know, that children are around fire at a very early age. You were telling me a story of a child learning fire at a very, very young age.
It's grandbabies.
Grandbabies, that they are learning it. I think, was it the one that was 19 months old? I can't remember, but so young.
That was my grandson. He likes to burn his Angelica Rude.
His Angelica Rude.
Margot's grandchildren burn with her. She's been teaching them how to burn. And the real cute part is she does what we call an after-action review, where we discuss what went good in the fire, what do we need to do better, you know, how do we behave. And it was very cute to see her grandchildren's response about, you know, you don't play with fire, you don't spin it around your head, you know. They had all kinds of really amazing things to say. So it's fun working with children.
Right. Well, you know, I wondered for you, because you were around fire at such a young age, whether it was always something kind of magical and alchemical for you, because I feel that's part of fire's nature.
Yeah. I have a very interesting relationship with fire. You know, my partner, he's always really nervous about it. He's a retired nurse. Mm. He's used to being, you know, indoors. He's an outdoorsman. He likes to hunt and do all those mm-hmm. things, but fire is not his thing.
Got it.
And usually when I'm burning, he will ask everyone else around me if I'm okay or if I'm being safe, but uh-huh. he never voices that to me. Which I find kind of interesting. But you know, I burn at home a lot. And sometimes he'll be like, oh my God, what are you doing? And I'm like, well, we're going to get wind in 2 hours. I got to get this done. You know, for me, it's just a normal chore. For him, it's like, oh my God, you're not paying attention. Mm-hmm. But I really do pay attention to everything around me.
I'm sure you do. You know, I was wondering, when you are preparing for a burn, you know, how long that preparation is. I mean, I'm sure it's variable according to the size and so forth, but, you know, kind of a general, just any kind of idea of what's involved beforehand.
Yeah. Well, like I said, we burn twice a year, generally, the spring and the fall. The fall, we burn a little bit more than we do in the spring, depending on windows of snow and rain and whatever. Mm-hmm. But the planning is year long. You know, we don't take time off. The time in between burns is making sure our permits are good, making sure our burn plans are good, making sure everything is included in what we want to do all season long. Mm-hmm. So we don't have to keep going back and amending things.
Got it.
So it's planning for the future continually.
So how do you, I mean, do you, we used to, our people, we used to think that we had a fire season here in California. And I don't, mm-hmm. you know, nowadays people think differently on that, you know, we have fires in fall, we have fires in summer, but that's all because we're out of balance now. So I wonder, you know,
yeah.
how you address that now with your burns, given the different contexts that we're in with climate change and the nature of degraded
yeah.
soil here and drought and all the factors.
Yeah, I'm extremely lucky to live in a very, very wooded area. I'm directly above the confluence of the Klamath and Trinity Rivers, mm-hmm. Like I said, above my family's village. Everything here is about 2 to 3 months earlier than normal.
Okay.
So I do the food securities for cultural fire also. So I start my starts earlier. I start transplanting earlier. I start doing a lot of things earlier, which helps me to pay attention to my fire weather. We start paying attention to the rainfall, how much we get, how many days in between, you know, rain, how many days of sun are we going to get? Everything becomes a plan. Everything is the great plan. You know, we're constantly looking at it to see when is our next burn window. Mm-hmm. You know, we're trying to pull off a burn window this weekend. If we can do that, we'll get a prairie reburned. This will be our third entry on it. And just being able to do that, that's where I've seen one of the elk come through our territory. So it's real nice to know that those elk are moving back into our world.
It's amazing what can happen when the habitat is restored, just who comes back organically. It just happens.
It's
a beautiful thing to witness.
Yeah. We're kind of spoiled. Our grad students have cameras out in some of their study plots, so we get to see the bear and the deer and the bobcats and mountain lions and things that just tend to wander through the forest.
Yeah. You know, I wondered, when you talk about these windows, you know, whether over the 7 years, given that these megafires have been increasing, especially over the last 5 years, what has changed in the way you plan over those 7 years? Have you found that the windows are smaller?
Yeah, they're a little different. They're a little more erratic than they normally would have been. We could normally plan on a week of really good weather where we know that we're going to be able to put off a perfectly good 10-day burn. Mm-hmm. Now we're lucky if we can get 3 to 5 days of good weather, mm-hmm. you know, that's not too windy, not too stormy. You know, the conditions have to be just right. And, you know, over the last 7 years, we have seen the changes in the environment. We've seen the changes in, you know, mostly it's policies that hinder what we do. We've literally had to fight to convince people that we know what we're doing, we're good at what we're doing, mm-hmm. we're not going to cause another problem. Mm-hmm. You know, it's selling yourself, basically. It's selling a product. And at this point, fire is what everyone fears, and it's what we work with.
Right. It's natural to you. But do you find that that perception has changed? I mean, they feel like they're kind of out of solutions, you know, because their solutions don't work, or it's insufficient and it's misguided. So I don't know if you really found that there has been an increasing receptivity and even outreach to Native peoples, because they know that they don't know how to deal with fire, really.
Yeah, okay. No, we have actually trained quite a few Forest Service participants, and CAL FIRE comes out and burns with us. Mm-hmm. You know, in the beginning, they would just come and watch, see if we knew what we were doing, make sure that we weren't doing anything out of line. And uh-huh. then eventually they just got to the point where now they send participants out to work with us. We've trained some of their archaeologists. We've trained some of their, you know, fire students. Mm-hmm. It's just become a nice fit for them to understand that there's another level to fire that they're using, you know, what they're taught, the suppression right. piece.
There's another
piece. So there is also another piece that's, yeah, it's another tool that they didn't have before.
Different perspective of looking at the fire, relating with the fire, I should say.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know, it's a good thing. We've even had young natives from other tribes come that are from the military, who've mm-hmm. been working in different agencies in the military itself. And mm-hmm. some of them wanted to come and see what we were doing because they wanted to restore their reservations. And now, so it was really nice to have that.
Yeah, it's wonderful to spread the wisdom, for sure, you know, and regain it, because, or reclaim it, because some people don't, maybe the elders in their community are no longer around who would have known about how to do cultural burning.
It's true. For us, you know, the piece that's really, I guess it's difficult for me, because for us, we have multi-generational homes. You mm-hmm. know, you're exposed to your grandparents, and, you know, my grandchildren have my mother, you know, they still have their great grandmother.
Right.
And so they're used to hearing things. We have an oral history. We don't have a written history. It's just now that they're starting to document our language and to teach it in the universities and the schools. But, you know, storytelling is a huge piece of who we were, sitting around the fire, talking about, mm-hmm. you know, where we came from, our villages, our families. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, kids get used to that. Yeah. They know that they get to lay on their grandma or their grandpa, and they get to hear stories. They get to hear about how they came to be. Mm-hmm. And so it's a piece that's missing in modern society. Everyone lives in their own little space and doesn't want anyone in their space. You know,
and
that
the fire
makes
is an
it
essential
hard
piece.
To interact with the universe.
Sure. And the fire is an essential piece yeah. of that, gathering around the fire, right? And then we have
absolutely.
On top of that, the overlay of the yeah. bed and everything that draws up. With the piece of trying
yeah.
to distance is more something that is imposed as a norm versus intimacy and family, you know.
Yeah, it's really funny. My kids asked me how we were doing with isolation, and we didn't realize that our normal day is isolation. You know, we live in the woods.
Yeah.
We
yeah,
still
right.
hunt. We still gather. Mm-hmm. You know, I see my mom. I take her firewood. I take her things. Uh-huh. Then I come home. You know, that's just our normal day.
Right.
But in that day, you know, I see other relatives. I, you know, see neighbors. I drop off foods or whatever.
Right. Yeah.
But it's just, it's really different here. You know, isolation in the city is completely different than isolation
right.
in the wilderness.
Yeah. I would say isolation in the wilderness, there's more connection. But isolation in the city is often loneliness, or, you know, it there's some kind of a more of a separation involved in that. It's not the same. Yeah.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you the.
You know, it was funny when I lived.
You go ahead.
No, go ahead. It's fine. Go ahead.
I wanted to ask you what the difference is. You talk about burning in a traditional context, and also that there's burning in a contemporary way. So I don't know if there's any kind of integration between the two, why that comes up, you know, the different contexts.
When we are doing the training exchanges, we use drip torches, fusees,
okay.
you know, various different things to start the fire.
So the
when I am doing a traditional or a cultural burn, I use wormwood, angelica root, and even pitchy sticks to start my fire.
Mm-hmm.
I don't try to use any chemicals at all. Matter of fact, there is no herbicides, fungicides, GMOs, anything on our reservation. We don't allow it.
Right. And is it also when you are...
We try to stay as chemical free.
And is it also when you're doing those burns with wormwood and angelica, that's also kind of a sacred, is it also an offering in that way? Or is that part of the process?
For me, yeah. So I've always said a prayer quietly before we started our prescribed burns for our treks. Mm-hmm. Margot asked me to do those during the opening of our burns now. Mm-hmm. And so basically when I open our prayer, it's asking permission from the grandparents to put the greatest tool to use. Mm-hmm. And asking permission from the one-legged tree people and the birds and the animals to come into their home and to put fire on their ground, you know, mm-hmm. to restore the land, to restore their food, and, you know, to help them as well as us. So, you know, there's a huge connection there. You have to include everyone in that environment. We can't just walk in and say, oh, I'm going to do this and you're going to like it. Right. It doesn't work that way.
Right.
You know, you have to have permission from the ancestors. You have to have their wishes to make this right. So, you know, as another, a participant of ours, you know, she said that that was the first time she had ever cried at a training. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I apologized. I was like, oh, my God, I didn't mean to make you cry. And she said, no, I had never heard anyone invoke their ancestors before to ask permission.
People you don't know to ask.
To me, permission. That's part of who we are.
Right. Step
know,
number one,
right? You
have
to ask permission. You cannot just assume. Yeah.
You do not absolutely. Pass go, right, without so, asking you know, for permission.
Exactly. You know, the ancestors are in charge no matter how much we like to balk.
Right. People like to do things unilaterally, but that's what is the, you know, the problem with, you know, society here as we know it, like colonial settler kind of society just operates that way, you know?
Yeah.
It's DIY. Everything yeah. is all about the ego and the self and, it, you know. But, you know, I wondered if you could.
It's true.
Share a little bit about these elder structure protection burns and how you go about that and what that actually does and how long, you know, is that also twice a year or what, how does that work?
The elder structure burns usually happen during our family burns. Mm-hmm. So a family member has to be there to ignite the fire. And then our crew and family members that participate, we guide the fire. We take care of it. We burn all around their home. We leave a complete fire buffer.
Okay.
If they have natural resources on their property, they allow families to come and gather. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just something we do to protect our elders. You know, they've done everything for us. Now it's our turn to do for them. Mm-hmm. So it's extremely important to make sure our elders are safe, that our single families are safe, you know, that our community is not going to burn up. It's right. It's our top priority. It's land so, restoration and security of our people.
So is it mostly that people come to you for that or that everyone kind of knows or I sees that so-and-so's house is not looking so safe or we should be doing that?
It depends, you know, people apply to have their property burned through our program. We prioritize them based on cultural resources and elder structure protection. Like I said, we need to make sure that they're safe. But we have stacks and stacks of applications of people wanting to have us help them. And we're a small group, which is why we're hiring and training more people so that we can accommodate, you know, all these families.
It seems it will only increase. You know, I also just wanted to quickly ask whether you're also working with public lands or only on reservation land primarily.
I actually just did a tour of a plot in Orrick, California with the Save the Redwoods League. Mm-hmm. So we'll be burning with some of the park services that are in our ancestral territory. The Yurok ancestral territory is 40,000 hectares.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Which Margot taxed us with burning. So it's going to be a minute or two before we get
in. Yeah, just a minute. You know, we are unfortunately have to close out our interview, but I wondered if you could share some of the links where people can connect with you, if you can share about, I don't know if the current treks has already happened or is coming up, if you could share with listeners, how can they remain connected with you and the work that the Culture Fire Management Council is doing?
Yeah, Cultural Fire Management Council has a Facebook page and an Instagram page, but you can also, you can find the links for the prescribed burning, the treks on the Nature Conservancy's prescribed fire page.
Okay.
And you can apply there. They take all the applications and then they notify us how many people, and then we go through and pick. Our largest treks has been 50 participants, which was much too large for us. So we normally go to about 30 people.
Okay. Well, we will post out all the links as well so that listeners can find you. And we thank you so much for just being connected to your deep lineage and traditions, and for carrying this forward for future generations. It is our blessing and our privilege to speak with you tonight. So thank you, Elizabeth.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm honored.
We are so grateful to you and all that you and Margot and the rest of, are all doing. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you to our guest today, Elizabeth Azus, Secretary of Cultural Fire Management Council, and thank you to our listeners for joining us. This has been Cultural Fire, Native Land Management and Regeneration.
KBOO, Portland, Oregon, bridging the gap between prisons, prisoners, and the community. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Here at KBOO, we honor the indigenous people whose traditional and ancestral homelands we stand on. The Multnomah, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Tumwater, Wetlala Bands of the Chinook, the Tualatin Kalapuya, and many other indigenous tribes and nations of the region of the Willamette River and that great river known as Shuaneku, Wimal, Nishaiwana, and Columbia. Many names for the living water force that has sustained this region for countless generations and provided phenomenal life to our blessed ecosystems. We believe it is important to acknowledge the ancestors of this land